Learn more about Dream Factory of Greater Kansas City and the Boulevard of Dreams Gala all this month at Community Lending of America's site, clakc.com.
The Midcoast Radio Project, an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer, is accepting applications for a full-time Director of Development and Communications at KKFI 90.1 FM. For a list of responsibilities, required qualifications, salary range, and the application process, go to kkfi.org, click on About, and then click on Employment.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. On today's show, host David Bell speaks with Dr. Amy Griffith in an insightful and thought-provoking discussion about sex offense. Dr. Griffith is the expert. She is the Clinical Director of Sex Offense Services for Missouri Department of Corrections. From misconceptions about people who have committed sex offenses, to educational opportunities with our children to prevent sexual violence, we can learn about ourselves from studying how society treats sex offenders. They talk about misconceptions we need to expose in order to better understand the problem. We'll play our calendar at the midpoint of the hour. The director of the Missouri Department of Corrections is mandated under statute to develop a program of treatment, education, and rehabilitation for sexual assault offenders. By department policy, the successful completion of the Missouri Sex Offender Program, MOSOP, is mandatory for a release prior to an inmate sentence completion date. Dr. Griffith explains that treatments have two goals. First, to prevent reoffense. Secondly, to assure offenders live successful lives in their community when they're released. We hope you will listen. On Jaws of Justice, we examine how to find justice in our society. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are. Now, our show.
You know, I met Dr. Griffith in somewhat unusual circumstances. A friend of mine had been a victim of sexual violence, and the person that assaulted her was in prison. And my friend wanted to speak with someone about the treatment this person was getting. So Dr. Griffith, my friend, and I talked for a few hours over several phone calls. And in listening to Dr. Griffith, I was taken aback at her ability to keep a balanced perspective in the face of horrific stories that she must listen to in order to do her job, which, when you think about it, is to make sure that when offenders hit the streets, that the risk of reoffending is as low as it could possibly get. And that's surely a tall order. As a criminal defense attorney, I'm certainly interested in the sex offender program at the Missouri Department of Corrections. I mentioned the 120-day SOAU program, often called 120-day callback, the intricacies of getting in and getting out. You know, but that's not what attracted me to Dr. Griffith. Rather, after listening to Dr. Griffith for a while, it became clear that one of her passions is to deal with sexual assaults before they happen, to be proactive rather than reactive. And as with other topics, this requires us to look inward and not outward, which is another tall order. You know, I then started thinking about the images I saw growing up. I remember when I was 12, I remember a movie at the time, Anthony Michael Hall being handed the keys by the jock to a Rolls Royce with an attractive, passed out cheerleader in the front seat. The message was, if you make sure you get her home safe, she's yours. To make matters worse, of course, looking back, and in her drunken state, she started to actually come on to Anthony Michael Hall. And then, after it was all done, the next morning when they kissed, she said that while she wasn't sure if she remembered the act, she certainly enjoyed it. I definitely related to the Anthony Michael Hall character versus the jock character, and while I was never in that situation, I can only imagine how those images presented to a 12-year-old boy at that time. To help us understand a little bit more about ourselves, I've asked Dr. Amy Griffith to be here. Dr. Griffith, thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Griffith, what is your current position?
So I currently serve as the statewide clinical director of sexual offense services for the Missouri Department of Corrections.
All right. And what does that mean? What are you in charge of then?
So basically, any person who is incarcerated for a sexual offense conviction will go through, they have the option of going through the treatment program. So I'm in charge of that program as well as assessments.
All right. And when you're looking at the Missouri Sexual Offender Treatment Program, what is your ultimate goal in that program as to offenders?
So we have two primary goals. The first one is probably the most obvious and pervasive throughout DOC, which is we don't want any more victims. We want to prevent reoffense. But the second is we want our offenders to be released into the community and be to, and live a more pro-social, balanced life. So we want them to be successful in the community.
All right. And when I talked to you about treatment, it sounded like treatment for sex offenders is different than treatment as I may deal with a therapist. Is that right? I mean, the ultimate goal is different, perhaps.
I would say it's narrower in scope, for sure. You know, when you go to a therapist as just someone in the community, you have kind of a specific presenting problem. You're also choosing to go to a therapist in most cases. The people that we work with they have very limited choice. So it's a statute-mandated program in the sense that they have to complete it before they can be eligible for early release. So you could be convicted of murder in the state of Missouri and be eligible for conditional release, but someone convicted of a sex offense has to complete programming or they get their max date, their max release date. So they serve their entire sentence. And so that's a technically a choice to participate in treatment, but it's based on freedom or not.
Meaning if they complete the program, that's going to make it more likely that they get out a little bit earlier.
Yes.
Rather than having to serve their entire sentence.
Yes. And then another kind of way it's slightly different is, you know, with a therapist in the community, you could kind of talk about a wide array of different things. Our focus is very narrow in scope. We really are focused on the sex offending behaviors that got the offender to be where they are, and we want to develop skills to prevent that from happening again.
And I got the impression from speaking to you before that depression, things like my depression, my anxiety, you know, things that I may see a counselor for, those aren't necessarily at the forefront of treatment.
No.
That you're dealing with. Is that right?
Right. Correct.
And why is that?
Well, those things, quite frankly, have been shown in the research literature to not be related to reoffense. And so, again, we're focusing on reoffense, what would allow this person to be successful in the community rather than committing another sex offense. And so we focus on the things that have been shown in the literature to be, in the research, to be related to those, to that issue.
You know, along those lines, I know it's very difficult to look out and spot someone who's potentially dangerous. I mean, I want to be able to look into society and point to that person and that person or that characteristic. And I'm wondering, from your standpoint, what is the biggest predictor of a person committing a sex offense for the first time?
For the first time, being male.
Wow, just being male.
Correct.
And assuming someone is male, then what is the next biggest predictor in terms of connection between the offender and the victim?
The vast majority of sex offenses are committed by someone that the victim is either related to or in their immediate circle of trust or an acquaintance.
So if the biggest threat is men that we know, then why is it, at least the messaging I think I've received, the person I'm looking to focus on is the person jumping out of the bushes attacking someone that I know?
I mean, the stranger danger, whatever, PSA has been around since I was a kid, and that's just been the focus. It's always someone that is like the monster lurking in the dark alleyway and the trench coat behind the bushes. You know, there's a psychological phenomenon that we don't want to be like someone who could do something so terrible. So if we, you know, we don't want to envision that our fathers, our husbands, our uncles, our brothers could do things like that to someone else.
And, you know, one other thing in terms of kind of percentages, then we'll get into these specifics, is that the statistic about the percentage of offenders that are brand new offenders, meaning that aren't recidivist, at least as far as the criminal justice system knows, what is that approximate percentage?
So it's roughly 85 to 90% of sexual offenses are new offenders.
Which means that the recidivism rate in general is about 13 to 15%.
Correct.
Okay. And is it that 13 to 15%, that's lower if they've gone through treatment, is that right?
Yes.
I see. So if 80% of the offenders are first-time offenders, at least the criminal justice system is aware, and the recidivism rate for sex offenders that have gone through treatment is relatively low, it looks like we ought to be focusing more on preventing the first-time offense.
Well, yeah, that would be great.
So let's talk then about where we're going wrong with that. And I think the first thing I'd want to talk to you about are general misconceptions. And the first misconception that we talked about before today and that we're talking about today is this misconception that we're looking for this stranger danger, this person lurking somewhere out in the dark mm-hmm. that we're scared of. And I wonder if we could talk briefly about what the implications of that are, what the implication of that misconceptions are with regard to protecting individuals from sexual abuse and or being able to spot individuals or behaviors that we maybe should be more aware of.
Well, again, if you're always looking around your, you know, looking over your shoulder or looking around a corner for somebody that you don't know, you're going to ignore signs or red flags that might be happening right in front of you in your own home, potentially. And so that is, I think, the biggest danger of doing that. And or you might not, and this may be worse, if, let's just say, a child does report some form of abuse, you may not believe the child because you can't imagine, you know, whoever it is doing such a thing.
So it's this preconceived notion that if it's the person lurking in the out in the bushes, then it certainly can't be anybody around me. And
right.
if we go into it with that mindset, then we won't be open to potentially people around me doing something that we should be more cognizant of.
Yes, and then the flip side of that is when we assume that it's always strangers, monsters lurking in the shadows doing this kind of thing, it perpetuates one of the biggest myths, which is that that people who commit sex offenses are 100% terrible human beings. So, you know, it's not just that this idea that, oh, your husband, you should be suspicious of your husband or your father's or your uncle's. It's that people who commit sex offenses are human. And so there's other aspects about them that are, you know, potentially okay and pro-social. And so it just perpetuates this myth that only monsters could do such a thing.
But there certainly is a desire, and I don't know what it is, but I've seen it myself, potentially in others, to want to almost to negate the humanity
yes.
of the person that would do something like that. But it sounds to me from what you're saying that that comes with certain costs. One of the costs is that you don't necessarily see the people around you that could be doing something or not. But I feel like there's also an additional cost to that, and I don't know maybe what that would be. Negating anyone's humanity, I think, winds up hurting me just as much or more than it wind up hurting the other person. And I'm trying to put my finger on that. I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's when you negate humanity of an individual, you're not looking at the person as a whole. And so, and this may be getting off topic a little bit, but every person has a good and a bad side. There's dark, there's light, you know, there's black, there's white. Every person has good things about them and bad things about them. I'm sure you do. I'm sure I have bad habits that I'm not proud of, but there's also things that I do that I'm proud of. So same. I mean, it's just viewing this person as a human being and therefore treating them as such, even though they've made a mistake that is extremely harmful in a lot of cases. And so, you know, I don't know. I guess that's my best explanation for that is that it enables people to be treated terribly if you ignore or negate their humanity.
Well, and then we've talked before in another show about how the treatment of someone, if negating their humanity and treating them as such, and sometimes winds up placing them in the very position to commit or be more susceptible to committing the very acts that we don't want them to commit, isolating them, taking away
for sure.
Family, friends, placing them in an island, if you will.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, our system is set up that we really set these folks up for failure when they get released. You know, here we are trying to work on making them successful, developing skills to have better, healthier habits in the community. But then they get into the community and they are restricted from everything. They can't live anywhere near anything. And usually they are limited from contact with their closest supports. And so, you know, we give very little leeway to these people for making a mistake because the assumption is they're going to make the worst mistake of all.
So one of another misconception that you and I had talked about is that once a sex offender, always a sex offender.
Yeah.
Tell me about that misconception.
There's a huge misconception kind of alongside that every person who's committed a sex offense has multiple offenses that they've committed. You know, it's never just the one. There's always, a million other offenses that they've committed. And that's not true either. But it's this assumption that once you have committed an act like that, then you're always going to want to do it again. And that's just simply not true.
And why is that not true? How do we know that's not true?
Well, we know that from recidivism data. Mm-hmm. And we also know that from, talking to the offenders. I mean, years and years and years and the largest sample sizes of various research studies that we have, a lot of these men don't want to do it again. They don't like what they've done. They feel terribly ashamed of what they've done. And they don't want to hurt somebody else.
But the impression I get sometimes, at least the way it's portrayed in society, is that there's this person sitting there, and as if a child or someone within their kind of their reach is brought before them, they won't be able to help themselves but to reach out and offend.
Right.
And that's not realistic, I guess.
No, and there's different, of course, there's most sex offenses are kind of broken down into two different types, people who molest children or people who rape adults. And I think the people who molest children are obviously given the most kind of they're the ones whose humanity is negated the most.
Mm-hmm.
But the percentage of men who have a true sexual interest in children is very, very low. So in terms of this is the only sexual interest that I have is children, that percentage is very, very low.
The other thing we talked about was that all sex offenses are equally predictive of future offenses.
Right.
But that's a misconception. Help me understand what that misconception is.
So there's lots of different risk factors that are involved in, predicting reoffense. And those risk factors have all been shown in the research to be related to reoffending. And whether they're intuitive or not, not all, so for instance, you mentioned before, people who have committed a sex offense against someone who is related to them, that actually it reduces their risk. It doesn't increase their risk to reoffend.
Okay.
So versus if they had committed an offense against an unrelated person or even a stranger, that actually does increase their risk for reoffending. So whether there's, criminal history there's a huge part of that. There's just different variables involved. And so you have to look at all of those different things so not all people who commit sex offenses are created equal, and their risk for reoffending is also not equal.
And one of the other things we talked about, and this was kind of surprising, although I had spoken to a victim advocate who brought this up, is that individuals that commit sex offenses were themselves victims of sex offenses, that has to be the case. And I was speaking to a victim advocate who formerly victim advocate and worked at Jackson County Prosecutor's Office, and she said, well, David, if that's the case, then all sex offenders would be women.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, I don't really have a good answer to that one.
That's actually, that's a great response. So, yeah, I mean, no, there's actually, there's some, of course, who've had traumatic experiences, but the vast majority of people who've committed sex offenses have I'm not going to say have no trauma history, but they don't have, like, a sex offense history specifically. So, there's probably some level of trauma there somewhere, but not necessarily a sexual offense.
And what would be some of these risks to reoffend, just so our audience understands that in general? We've talked about, for first-time offenders, the highest predictors, are you a man? But in terms of reoffending, I'm curious, what are some of those factors?
Well, at the very basic level, there's different types. So there's what we call static or historical risk factors, and those are things that we can't change. And so those things, I think, are probably maybe the most kind of counterintuitive, because they're things like, your age, victim type, those kinds of things that we just talked about being related or unrelated. But the ones that we really tend to focus on in treatment because we can do something about them are what we call dynamic risks. And those are things like your sexual interests, your problem-solving skill ability, your cooperation with authority and supervision and things like that. you know, rule following behavior. If you have a history of committing a lot of crimes, well, then you're probably going to commit another crime. So it's overarchingly sexual interests, deviant sexual interests specifically, and antisociality. So kind of this high level of criminality and a lack of concern about hurting somebody else.
So it sounds like you're not necessarily trying to stop the thoughts or stop the feeling, whatever that may be, but rather it's the reaction to the thoughts and the feeling that we're dealing with. Meaning the interest arises up in some way. You see a sex offender, someone sees a young woman who's obviously a girl, very underage. They have some attraction to them, physical attraction, and okay, that is what it is. But then the question is, now what do I do with that?
Yeah, and so there's a lot that goes into that.
Sure.
So there's no one like kind of simple explanation for that or simple kind of pathway for that. But yes, all those risk factors kind of combine. It could be, you know, that they don't even recognize that that's a younger or underage person.
Oh, interesting.
It could be that they just don't have the experience or the learning, the socialization to understand, hey, just because I'm attracted to somebody doesn't mean I have to approach them. You know, so there's all kinds of different possible scenarios that could lead to an offense situation.
But that sounds like the treatment would be, what I'm calling treatment, would be more in helping the offender understand those thoughts and understand why acting out on those thoughts is not acceptable
yes.
in society.
Yeah, so, I mean, your question from before about how does the treatment that we work with differ from somebody who has depression or anxiety, there are some similarities in the sense that we are working with maybe some core beliefs that are problematic, you know, things that they learned from family of origin issues or whatever, kind of long-held belief systems that could have affected their offense patterns.
Oh, interesting.
But then there's all these other things that are very specific to sex offense recidivism that we're also working with. So we to kind of go back to your original question, yes, we want them to recognize what thoughts were problematic. Mm-hmm. We want to help them develop ways to change those thoughts. And so we do hope that their feelings are different and their thoughts are different. We recognize that that may not happen immediately, and it will happen over time, hopefully, because it takes a while to develop a new skill or a new habit. But ideally, they will eventually learn to have different feelings stemming from different thoughts and then behave differently.
But, you know, in the next half hour, we're going to talk about kind of what would Dr. Griffith do if she could go to the earliest levels of education of young boys and young girls to prevent potential sex offenses or what I'll call microaggressions. We've heard that term mm-hmm. in other areas, but it seems to me the treatment that you're talking about, at least for MOSOP, isn't necessarily, or is it going against, or not going against, is it attempting to unravel some of these maybe constructs that young boys, particularly, and young girls, learn very early on when they don't even know they're learning it from movies or society or seeing their parents interact in certain ways?
Yeah, in some cases, yes. I mean, if it's relevant for that particular individual, yes, then we would do that.
Any other misconceptions that we...
The biggest misconception is that all people who commit sex offenses will reoffend, that they will do it again, and that's kind of that leading, you know, alongside that infinite number of victims issue, and they just don't. You know, I think if you polled 100 people in the community, they would probably, almost all of them would say that, you know, you'd get ranges definitely above 50% about, you know, what's the likelihood you think someone would commit a new sex offense in the future. They would, I think most of them would say above 50%. That's what I've experienced. And it's that 13 to 15% percentage.
But I guess, Dr. Griffith, I hear it intellectually what you're saying. But part of me is I have a family. Mm-hmm. I have close friends that have children. You know, your statistics are good, but on the same part, there's part of me that just fears, right? And I see that with other families that fear, all right, wait, we're going to put this person back in the community, and they're okay to be around children because it's usually with a male that knows their victim. that part is that emotional reaction to it. I don't know how you move past that in a society. What I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I mean, I have my thoughts, and then there's the application, right. Which are very different. You know, the fact of the matter is, someone who commits an offense against someone that they know or that's in their immediate family, they're not going to have contact with that person when they get back in the community, at least not for a long time. It will probably not be until that particular victim is an adult, and then they can figure out, you know, how they want to reunify or have contact later. But, you know, if it is, like, let's say someone who didn't offend against a family member, and so, but they have a family, they might be able to have contact with their family, move back in with their family. And yeah, I mean, the concern, I get the concern. I totally empathize with the concern. But again, the vast majority of these men are low risk, or there's a low likelihood that they will reoffend. And so, especially if they've been through treatment, if they've developed skills to behave differently, they're going to have restrictions. So there'll be a lot of stipulations that they will have to
But it's interesting. You know, I find myself, as we've talked about this, you and I have had conversations before about this, and I find myself, as we talk going through it, falling into the same emotional trap that I'm saying is maybe part of the problem. I want to push this out into the person that's hiding in the bushes and not somewhere close, not even things that I may, qualities that I may have or people I know may have. And I want to push it out, but then in doing so, I fall into the same trap that we've been talking about. So
right.
I see the tension there between the...
Yeah, I do too. And I get it.
All right.
You got it.
We've been talking with Dr. Amy Griffith, statewide clinical director of the Missouri Sex Offender Program at the Missouri Department of Corrections. We've been talking about common misconceptions. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the messages that are sent by media, by individuals, parents, things, whatever it may be, that may present certain beliefs to children that make it more likely that sex offenses will happen in the future. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Support for KKFI is provided by the Kansas City Museum, located at 3218 Gladstone Boulevard in the historic Northeast. The new Kansas City Museum is now open, featuring exhibits, programs, and experiences encompassing Kansas City's past, present, and future. You can find a full list of events as well as ways to support the museum, all at kansascitymuseum.org.
Let's explore, let's question, let's decolonize together on Ebony's Bones.
Tune in every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
KKFI is accepting applications for a full-time director of development and communications. As part of the Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For a list of job responsibilities, required qualifications, salary range, and the application process, go to kkfi.org/employment.
Now the calendar for the week of March 28th. If you haven't been vaccinated yet, you can find a vaccine. See the facts at kcmo.gov. Legal Aid of Western Missouri can provide free civil legal services to low-income and vulnerable people who live in Jackson County, Missouri. Interested individuals can call 816-474-6750 to apply. For Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense virtual meetings this week, go to momsdemandaction.org. All are welcome, mothers and others. Kansas Moms Meeting is Monday, March 28th, 7:30 p.m. on Zoom. Friday, April 1st, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Missouri Day of Empathy is an online event supporting community safety and criminal justice reform. Access link is available on our pages. Saturday, April 2nd, 9 a.m., The Assault on Reproductive Freedom, a virtual event, is hosted by the League of Women Voters of Johnson County, Kansas, open to anyone. Reproductive freedom is, once again, under attack in Kansas. You can join us for a robust discussion about the importance of defeating the August 2022 ballot measure to amend the Kansas Constitution. Learn how you can protect the right to control personal decisions about reproductive health and abortion care. You can register in advance for this webinar on Facebook. After registering, you will receive a confirmation email containing information about joining the webinar. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. The list is updated daily. Please, take care of yourselves and others. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as on the Jaws of Justice Radio page at the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We return to hear more from David Bell speaking with Dr. Amy Griffith, Clinical Director of Sex Offense Services for the Missouri Department of Corrections.
This is David Bell. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. Our guest today is Dr. Amy Griffith. She's the statewide clinical director of the Missouri Sex Offender Program at the Missouri Department of Corrections. The last half of the hour, we talked about misconceptions and of sex offenders. You know, for this half, I want to talk about what it is we can do based upon your experience, doctor, and your knowledge to prevent sex offenses from happening at all. And I spoke briefly at the beginning in the intro about the 16 candles video. Yeah. and how seeing that as a 12-year-old boy had to have some impact on me. And so I'm wondering if we could go back in time to even, you know, kindergarten, whatever it may be, and I could place you there, doctor, what different messages would you potentially be sending to children and parents that may help us down the road prevent sexual assaults, or what I call these kind of microaggressions that I know a lot of women have to deal with? How do we even begin this journey?
Well, to speak to that movie, that was definitely a movie of my childhood too, and I'll just speak from the perspective of the girl in the car. When I saw that scene, that definitely sent the message to me that, oh, you're passed out unconscious and somebody has sex with you. You just wake up and it's just great and you enjoy every minute of it. So that definitely had, you know, a kind of a disconcerting message for me from the opposite side of things.
But did you know at the time it was disconcerting when you saw it?
Probably not as a kid, but, you know, watching it as an adult, you know, definitely had the thoughts of like, gosh, I remember just kind of glossing over this scene and not thinking much of it. And now I'm like, this is really troubling.
Sure.
I think to answer your question more broadly, I think that really it boils down to how we socialize boys and girls. I mean, back to, you know, that girls are supposed to be sugar and spice and everything nice. Those kind of gender stereotyped messages that we send to our kids, the boys will be boys message, is probably one of the most toxic things you could say to a boy, because it lends itself to whatever he does is because he's a boy and it's totally normal.
Almost, you're saying, and let's go bear down on that a little bit, boys will be boys is a way of excusing behavior, but also it sounds like almost like excusing the requirement that I would want for any child I have or a friend's child to determine what the impact is on the other person.
Yeah. I mean, basically the message is that boys grow up to be men whose purpose in life is to have sexual conquests, and girls grow up to be women whose purpose in life it is to be conquested. You know, so that's really kind of the basic message. So the boys, you know, their whole goal is to, you know, you have sex with as many women as possible and you win them. And then girls are supposed to grow up learning to give in.
You know, I've seen that. A relative of mine likes to watch old kind of black and white movies. Mm-hmm. And there's scenes that I've seen repeatedly of a man grabbing a woman and kissing her, and there's a resistance, and then all of a sudden the resistance fades away to this desire of some sort, and that just sounds horrific, I guess, as we look back on it.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, what message does that teach people who are watching it? You know, so the man, you know, eventually wins the woman over, you know, leading boys watching that to believe that that's what happens, that women will eventually give in.
Just keep trying.
You push hard enough.
Right.
And then women are taught to think like, oh, if I don't want this, then something's wrong with me, because she's clearly giving in and enjoying this. Mm. And so it creates a lot of dissonance for both boys and girls.
You know, one of the things you taught me, it reminded me of it when I was a kid. I remember there was a young girl, I think her name was Lori or Lauren. I'll just use the first name. And she was mean to me. And I remember I went to my parents. I'm like, why is this girl being mean to me? Maybe I was 6 or 7. And I remember the response was, well, that must mean she likes you. And in speaking with you, you brought up an example of a little girl comes home and says, this boy's pulling my hair. And the response to the little girl is, oh, that must mean he likes you.
Yeah.
But I mean, doctor, that sounds so innocent. What's the problem there? What message is being sent there?
The implicit message is that if a boy likes you, he's hurting you, and that a girl is supposed to accept that kind of behavior from a boy.
And so, so let's extrapolate that forward a little bit. Then what? How do we get from there to someone you're going to be treating at some point in the future, or even one where the crime is not reported, but someone who maybe you should be treating in the future?
Well, I mean, from the girl's side, it could be that they feel like they can't give in to behavior that they don't like, mm-hmm. or that they don't want. And the boys just, they feel like that they can do whatever they want to get sex. So, I mean, it's just... the girl's supposed to shut up and like it.
Hmm. What about the other thing we've talked about is the boys kind of be quiet in terms of talking about emotions.
Yes.
As if that's a weakness in some way. Kind of the John Wayne kind of view, or at least how he appears. What's the problem with that?
So emotions have been long associated stereotypically with the female gender. Mm-hmm. You know, we were hysterical back in the Freudian days. And so if a boy is showing emotion, so there's a couple of messages that are very common. The idea that a boy can't express emotion, or he's acting like a girl, or you also hear, you know, I've heard so many parents, especially in sports, say something like, you run like a girl, you throw like a girl. Mm-hmm. And that, again, same kind of message that running like a girl is inferior. So basically all of those messages imply boys are supposed to act superior to girls. And if they're acting similar to girls, that they are inferior to what they should be.
And then what brings about this kind of attempt at some hypermasculinity or something?
Yes. I mean, that's essentially what toxic masculinity is, the idea that the male gender is superior to the female gender.
And then what? And then as a result, not as a result of that, but part and parcel of that is going on conquest to see how many women that I can have sex with? Is that because that's what I'm supposed to be doing as a...
I mean, if you perceive someone as beneath you, then you're not going to have a problem hurting them as much. You know, if I'm going to be less likely to hurt someone who is, you know, has the same level of power that I do. But if I perceive that I can get away with hurting someone because, and I may not even recognize that as hurting, you know, I may not have that perception of it necessarily consciously, but I'm more likely to take advantage of someone who I feel is inferior to me.
It's interesting, as you started talking about that, I'm reminded of the first half of the hour when we're talking about kind of dehumanizing someone.
Mm-hmm.
It almost sounds like a similar process in a way.
Yes, it is. It, you know, the objectification is kind of along with that.
And then I have to wonder out loud then if one of the concerns with that is that in addition to the pain it causes to others, to the extent to which it would it would impact the ability of the man, in this case, to form healthy, loving relationships, meaning he would be denied that, right? Because he can't, he doesn't have the tools to do it. He's looking at this mate as someone less than them, so it can't be potentially as wonderful or beautiful as it ideally could be.
Well, I mean, I think there's different, I guess there, it's a spectrum. You know, there's different levels to it, and I think in some extreme cases, yes, potentially, that could happen. But I also think, you know, boys who grow up to be men might struggle with how they're supposed to be in a healthy relationship. So if they're, you know, if they have an emotion, for instance, they suppress it, maybe don't express it because I'm not supposed to, you know, they're not supposed to express that because then they'll be perceived as weak or whatever. And so then that at the kind of lower end of the spectrum could create communication barriers, you know, all kinds of things, which then would contribute to a less than ideal relationship. But, you know, again, like you said, at the extreme end, it could perpetuate, you know, rape culture and the myths that a woman is really just good for sex.
Well, and, you know, I was thinking also about the going back to the 16 candles, that example. I remember there was a case, and I forgot, but it was of a fraternity member that was, raping a passed out woman behind a dumpster.
Oh, yeah.
Behind a fraternity house. And I think two, like, exchange students or someone, like, happened upon this guy and was like, what the hell are you doing? But it seemed like that, I mean, that scene right there is not very much different than what I saw in the movie.
Right.
It seemed like. Dr. Griffith, you know, one of the things you talked about was the term body autonomy, and I'm wondering if you could help me understand that a little bit better.
Sure. So one of the things that we can do with children is, you know, it's really common for kids to, you know, give grandma or grandpa a hug when they come in. And some kids will inevitably go through a phase where they don't want to. And so, you know, you don't make your kids hug someone that they don't want to hug, or you give them the choice to be able to do that. So that teaches them that they have autonomy over their bodies, which then in turn, if someone tries to do something that is not okay, then they feel confident in their ability to say no.
So let's break that down just a little bit. And I was thinking about this in my own life. There certainly is an idea that, you know, hugs from children certainly feel wonderful, right?
I mean, yes.
And at the same time, though, and at the same time, I guess you're saying if I go and just take the hug, number one, or the child is shamed into giving me a hug or grandma or grandpa a hug, that comes with a cost.
Yes.
And that cost is...
Well, again, it teaches them that what they want for their own bodies is not as important as what someone else wants.
Wow. That's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly a message like that that seems, at least as we look at it, so innocent. Think of how that could kind of percolate up.
Yes.
To eventually when they're in a position where we're talking about something much more serious.
Exactly. So if they're on a date, you know, as a 16-year-old, then, you know, somebody says, I want to do fill in the blank. And if they don't necessarily want that, but somebody else does, they may be more likely to give in to something they don't want to do.
Hmm. The other thing we talked about a little bit, maybe some things to do differently or things to think about, is the way sex education takes place in our society.
Well, that it takes place at all.
That it takes place at all, right.
I mean, really, we don't. I think... Understandably, you know, sex is kind of that last taboo, right? You know, so we don't talk about it openly. Nobody really talks about sex very openly. It's mm-hmm. It's kind of one of those things that's just behind me. It's just for the bedroom and that's it. So talking about sex to kids is really a terrifying idea,
yeah.
I think, for a lot of adults.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And so how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it in an age-appropriate way? I'm sure a lot of parents and adults are worried they're going to say something completely inappropriate.
Right. Yeah.
Or a lot of adults and parents may think they're putting ideas and into the kids' heads and they're going to start having sex as, you know, 6-year-olds, which won't happen, by the way.
Right.
So, yeah, it's terrifying. It's a terrifying idea.
And I know when we talked about the birds and the bees, maybe not the best way of going about things, I guess, would be the...
Right. Right. You know... Typically, the birds and the bees talk is how babies are made.
Right.
And that's, so then again, that kind of perpetuates this idea that sex is only for creating babies.
Right.
And then we're not taught as children about what healthy boundaries look like, what okay touches versus not okay touches look like. We're not taught about body autonomy. And so all of these things are wrapped up in how to you know, healthy sexuality. But we're only taught about literally the physical chemical components of how a baby is made. And that's literally like the least, well, I won't say it's the least common reason why people have sex, but I mean, it's, I think people have a lot more sex and a lot less babies.
Right. I hope.
Yeah. Right. Right. I mean, there's a lot more sex going on than having babies.
Right. So. And so that's interesting. So the idea of the birds and the bees is an idea of, all right, that there's body part goes with this body part, and
yes,
then this occurs to go into this space and this happens. It does almost seem that's interesting, and maybe we should know about it, right? But you're saying there's much more to sex education that we'd be able to provide. And one of those is boundaries. One of those is good touch, bad touch. But I'm trying to imagine how that would take place. I think I took sex ed in eighth grade. And I remember the work. I think I remember the textbook of it and the diagram. And, you know, a little bit of snickering that goes on when you see the various body parts. But I'm wondering how that even comes out, how you would even teach something like that.
Well, I think the fact that it's being done in schools is really kind of a testament to the fact that it's not happening at home.
Mm.
So really, that's the best place. And I don't. I hope I don't sound preachy, or I'm not trying to sound like I'm prescriptive, but it really, the parents are the best, the caregivers are the best folks to communicate very early on. I mean, the best time to talk about sex with your children is now.
Right.
They're going to be asking about it anyway. They're going to be learning about it. If they don't learn it from you, they're going to learn it from somebody else. And so, you know, at least you could have some sort of ability to control that narrative in a way that you feel appropriate for your own child. But, you know, you teach, so at home, ideally, and there's guides actually on the internet. There's all kinds of resources for parents that are amazing, and they're very, very clear and step-by-step on how to do that. But you basically just start out with, you know, a lot of parents don't even feel comfortable using the correct anatomical language for body parts, and you start out of the gate doing that.
And one of the things you and I have talked about before is the idea of shame, mm-hmm, in what I'll call in sex, whether it's talking about sex, whether it's, you know, shame, that the idea that it would be brought up outside the bedroom, whatever it may be. And I'm wondering, from a shame standpoint, that sounds like what we're talking about. Like, a child brings it up, and they're like, well, we don't talk about that, or don't say that name, or put that away, or whatever it may be, that may be an overreaction to it. The child learns shame from that. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, and particularly your career and the work that you do, how shame can manifest itself, not always, but how shame can manifest itself in people acting out sexually, or at least in harming others, whether it's harming others to the point of a crime, or whether it's just it's harming others something less than, but still obviously bringing about some pain and hurt to others.
So let me think about how to answer that. So, because that's like a huge question.
It is a huge question. I only like to answer the big question.
So I'll start out by saying that shame develops over a period of time when sex is taught to be a bad thing, a secretive thing. And so maybe any kind of expression of interest in any kind of sexual activity is reprimanded, you know, punished. And so shame develops over this course of time. If there's secrets involved, you know, secrets really don't have any place in sexuality. So once that person then has, you know, developed this kind of process of, well, I have these interests, I wasn't taught that this isn't okay or whatever, and so now I feel this shame about it, that just comes out in so many, it's just an unhealthy emotion.
Sure.
So,
but are there shame in the work that you do? Do you find, Do you see shame come up, either in individuals that are potentially in prison for child pornography or individuals for sexual assaults or things like that, that shame was somehow a component to it, that they were not either weren't able to talk it out and therefore they acted it out, or the behavior had to be so hidden that almost that in and of itself created a potential problem?
I think shame is really more of an after effect of the behavior. So in the moment, they may not be feeling that shame, or they may be, but it's usually manifested after they have committed a behavior that they're not proud of, or that they don't, you know, that harms somebody else.
But it would seem at a minimum, though, that the shame that would develop would prevent people from, again, a few of the things, engaging in a healthy relationship, I assume, with a consenting partner, if shame is involved with sex or sexual activity. I think it would almost prevent a growth of somebody in terms of being able to enter into a healthy relationship.
Well, so for that, I think, you know, shame would come into play if, let's say, somebody is in a relationship and they have sexual interests that they feel ashamed of. Mm-hmm. They won't communicate that to their partners. Mm-hmm. And then it just becomes this kind of secret. And so then they don't have a healthy sexual relationship, perhaps, or they don't enjoy sex, so they seek outlets elsewhere. Maybe they're watching pornography a lot or whatever. And so that's kind of how that comes into play in kind of a maybe a non-offending relationship, and that could potentially lead to an offense.
One of the things that we talked about before and that I was really interested in was how do you, given we know sex offenses are going to occur, and majority of them are not going to be recidivists, at least from the purposes of being known to the criminal justice system. How do we kind of be proactive with it? We've talked about some things, some messages that children are sent, and maybe how to be a more healthy kind of a talk, both in how we treat boys and how we treat girls and kind of the education we provide. Mm-hmm. But what about the individuals, the adults that are out there that haven't offended, or maybe they have and haven't been caught, and trying to reach those individuals before they get into the criminal justice system? Almost the middle ground. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but then again, you told me about a project that's ongoing that actually does that, and it seems to me this could be, I could see it getting a lot of grief from a lot of people, but at the same time, it intellectually it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's such an aspirational task that, I mean, the United States really doesn't have the reporting system that would support that right now, but other countries have much, have developed different systems where their goal is to capture, that's not the right word.
Wait a minute.
That's not the right word.
Right.
To encourage folks who haven't committed an offense yet, but maybe they're thinking about it, or they have a sexual interest that they feel ashamed of, to seek help. So it's kind of like seeking help prior to committing an offense, which is really what we want. We don't want someone to commit an offense. But if someone did that here in the United States, there would be all sorts of potential scary reporting issues. And of course, I mean, you know, of course, that's just how our system is set up. But yes, that you're talking about, the project that you're talking about is called Project Dunkelfeld, and it is in, it's occurring in Germany. And it's really, it's quite a landmark, groundbreaking program in the sense that they have actually they put out advertisements in, you know, buses, subways, on television, in magazines, whatever, newspapers, about, you know, encouraging people to, if they have some concerns about their sexual interests, to seek help.
And what you had told me about, that they put ads in subways, there's commercials on TV that are actually targeted towards gentlemen or men with thoughts about children, and it made me think of like To Catch a Predator, and it seemed like in the United States it's being done, but it's being done to catch someone.
Yes.
And put them in prison.
Yes.
Whereas here we're trying to catch someone, but not for purposes of putting them in prison, but rather, all right, here, let's offer some assistance here.
Yeah, like the word I used earlier, capture.
It's true. Like, but
yeah.
But it makes a lot of sense to me. And so, but I think it's interesting. How do you? Well, I guess we know from studies, whatever, maybe how to target ads or messages to individuals so it captures the attention of individuals that may be on the cusp of offending, and to put them into a position where they won't offend.
Hopefully. Yeah.
And is that, that's something we I don't we're not saying here in the United States?
No,
right now.
No. I mean, at maybe perhaps at an individual level, that would, you know, an occasional provider is doing that, but the vast majority of people, there's mandatory reporting laws, you know, and I think. I'm trying to normalize the idea that if somebody came into a therapist's office and said, Mr. or Ms. Therapist, I have sexual interest in children, I mean, I don't blame that therapist for kind of feeling a little freaked out. Like,
right.
Oh, I might, has this person already committed an offense? Do I report this? Like, you know, so there's not a system in place. There's not a specific place to refer these people that are seeking help.
And so I'm just imagining that session is like, all right, if you talk to me more about this, I'm a mandated reporter, I'm going to have to report you. So that shuts down the conversation, then the person goes out and potentially offends, and in a situation where that pain, that trauma could have been prevented, we wait until the trauma is inflicted and then we treat it.
Yes.
Which seems just backwards.
Yes.
To me. So how, I guess it's a final question, Doctor, how is it in your work, I guess maybe from a systemic point and maybe from a personal point, how do you define success in what you're doing?
Success is someone who doesn't commit another sex crime and is living a healthy life, just like you or me.
Dr. Griffith, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Enjoyed today's show, and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, you can send an email inquiry or comment to kkfi.org/contact. This is Jeff reminding you our outro music is Higher Ground from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with the Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Understanding Israel-Palestine at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike. And at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musicale.
This is Erica Benson with Project 28 Missouri for Women's History Month on KKFI Community Radio. Project 28 Missouri is working to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. The United States has fallen out of the top third of countries internationally ranked for gender equality. The U.S. is ranked as the 10th most dangerous country in the world for women. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The ERA will not only prohibit sex-based discrimination, but will authorize Congress to promote actual gender equality and eradicate gender disadvantages through new legislation. First introduced in 1923 by the National Woman's Party, and after a long battle, the ERA finally passed with a two-thirds vote in both chambers of Congress on March 22, 1972.